the appliers do actually pet the dogs, two hideous white golden retrievers with superated scabs and skin afflictions, plus one has grand mal epilepsy, it'll betray a level of desperate willingness that Pat says is just about all she goes by, deciding. A nameless cat oozes by on the broad windowsill above the back of the fabric couch. Animals here come and go. Alumni adopt them, or they just disappear. Their fleas tend to remain. Gately's intestines moan. Boston's dawn coming back on the green line this morning was chemically pink, trails of industrial exhaust blowing due north. The nail parings in the ashtray on the floor are, he realizes now, too big to be from fingernails. These bitten arcs are broad and thick and a deep autumnal yellow. He swallows hard. He tells Jeffrey Day how, even if they are just cliches, cliches are A, soothing, and B, remind you of common sense, and C, license the universal assent that drowns out silence, and 4, silence is deadly, pure spider food, if you've got the disease. Gene M. says you can spell the disease D-I-S-E-A-S-E, which sums the basic situation up nicely. Pat has a meeting at the Division of Substance Abuse Services and Government Center at noon she needs to be reminded about. She can't read her own handwriting, which the stroke affected her handwriting. Gately envisions going around having to find out who's biting their fucking toenails in the living room and putting the disgusting toenail bits in the ashtray at like 0500. Plus, house regs prohibit bare feet anyplace downstairs. There's a pale brown water stain on the ceiling, over Day and Treat, the almost exact shape of Florida. Randy Lentz has issues with Jeffrey Day because Day is glib and a teacher at a scholarly journal's helm. This threatens the self-concept of a Randy Lentz that thinks of himself as a kind of hiply sexy artist intellectual. Small-time dealers never conceptualize themselves as just small-time dealers, kind of like whores never do. For occupation, on his intake form, Lentz had put freelance scriptwriter, and he makes a show of that he reads. For the first week here in July, he'd held the books upside down in the northeast corner of whatever room. He had a gigantic medical dictionary he'd hauled down and smoke and read until Annie Parrott, the assistant manager, had to tell him not to bring it down anymore because it was fucking with Morris Hanley's mind. At which juncture he quit reading and started talking, making everybody nostalgic for when he just sat there and read. Jeffrey D. has issues with Randy L. also, you can tell. There's a certain way they don't quite look at each other. And so now, of course, they're mashed together in the three-man together, since three guys in one night missed curfew and came in without one normal-sized pupil between them and refused urines and got bounced on the spot, and so Day gets moved up in his first week from the five-man room to the three-man. Seniority comes quick around here. Past Minty, down at the dining room table's end, Bert F. Smith's still coughing, still hunched over, his face a dusky purple.
And Nell G. is behind him, pounding him on the back so it keeps sending him forward over his ashtray.
And he's waving one stump vaguely over his shoulder to try to signal her to quit. Lens and Day, a beef, maybe brewing. Day'll try to goad Lens into a beef that'll be public enough so he doesn't get hurt, but does get bounced, and then he can leave treatment and go back to Chianti and Ludes, and getting assaulted by sidewalks, and make out like the relapse is Ennett House's fault, and never have to confront himself or his disease. To Gately, Day is like a wide-open interactive textbook on the disease. One of Gately's jobs is to keep an eye on what's possibly brewing among residents, and let Pat or the manager know, and try to smooth things down in advance if possible. The ceiling's color could be called dun, if forced. Someone has farted. No one knows just who. But this isn't like a normal adult place where everybody coolly pretends a fart didn't happen. Here, everybody has to make their little comment. Time is passing. And it house reeks of passing time. It is the humidity of early sobriety, hanging and palpable. You can hear ticking in clockless rooms here. Gately changes the angle of one sneaker, puts the other arm behind his head. His head has real weight and pressure. Randy Lentz's obsessive compulsions include the need to be north, a fear of discs, a tendency to constantly take his own pulse, a fear of all forms of timepieces, and a need to always know the time with great precision. Day, man, you got the time maybe real quick? Lens. For the third time in half an hour. Patience, tolerance, compassion, self-discipline, restraint. Gately remembers his first 6 months here straight. He'd felt the sharp edge of every second that went by, and the freak show dreams, nightmares beyond the worst DTs you'd ever heard about. A reason for a night shifter staffer in the front office
is so somebody's there for the residents to talk at when,
not if, when the freak show dreams ratchet them out of bed at like 0300. Nightmares about relapsing and getting high. Not getting high, but having everybody think you're high. Getting high with your alcoholic mom and then killing her with a baseball bat. Whipping the old unit out for a spot urine and starting up and flames coming shooting out. Getting high and bursting into flames. Having a water spout shaped like an enormous tall one suck you up inside. A vehicle explodes in an enhanced bloom of sooty flame on the DEC viewer, its hood up like an old pop tab.
Day's making a broad gesture out of checking his watch.
Right around 0830, fella. Randy L's fine nostrils flare and whiten. He stares straight ahead, eyes narrowed, fingers on his wrist. Day purses his lips, leg joggling. Gately hangs his head over the arm of the sofa and regards Lens upside down.
That look on your map there mean anything, Randy? Are you like communicating something with that look?
Does anybody maybe know the time a little more exactly is what I'm wondering, Don, since Day doesn't. Gately checks his own cheap digital, head still hung over the sofa's arm.
I got 0832 14 15 16, Randy.
Thanks a lot, DG man. So, and now Day has that same flared look for Lens.
So we've been over this, friend. Amigo. Sport. You do this all the time with me. Again, I'll say it. I don't have a digital watch. This is a fine old antique watch. It points. A memento of far better days.
It's not a digital watch.
It's not a cesium-based atomic clock. It points with hands. See, Spiro Agnew here has two little arms. They point, they suggest. It's not a sodding stopwatch for life. Lentz, get a watch, am I right?
Why don't you just get a watch, Lentz? Three people I happen to know of for a fact have offered to get you a watch, and you can pay them back whenever you feel comfortable about poking your nose out and investigating the worker world. Get a watch. Obtain a watch. A fine, digital, incredibly wide watch, about five times the width of your wrist, so you have to hold it like a falconer. And it treats time like pie.
Easy does it, Charlotte Treat half sings, not looking up from her needle and frame. Day looks around at her.
I don't believe I was speaking to you in any way, shape, or form.
Lens stares at him. If you're trying to fuck with me, brother... He shakes his fine, shiny head. Big mistake.
Oh, I'm all a tremble. I can barely hold my arm steady to read my watch.
Big, real big mistake.
Peace on earth. Goodwill toward men, says Gately.
Back on his back, smiling at the dun cracked ceiling. He's the one who'd farted. They return from Long Island bearing their shields rather than upon them, as they say. John Wayne and Howland Condenza lost only five total games between them in singles. The A doubles had resembled a spatter painting, and the B teams, especially the Distaffs, had surpassed themselves. The whole PWTA staff and squad had had to sing a really silly song. Coyle and Trulch didn't win, and Teddy Schacht had, incredibly, lost to his squat, spin-doctory opponent in three sets despite the kid's debilitating nerves at crucial junctures. The fact that Schacht wasn't all that upset got remarked on by staff. Schacht and a conspicuously energized Jim Trulch rallied for the big win in 18A number 2 dubs, though. Trulch's disconnected microphone mysteriously disappeared from his gear bag during post-double showers, to the rejoicing of all. Pemulis's storky, intense, two-hands-off-both-sides opponent had gotten weirdly lethargic and then disoriented in the second set after Pemulis had lost the first in a tiebreak.
After the kid had delayed play for several minutes, claiming the tennis balls were too pretty to hit, PWTA trainers had conducted him, gently, from the court.
And the Peemster got VD, which is Junior Circuit Argot for a victory by default. The fact that Pemulis hadn't walked around with his chest out recounting the win for any ETA females got remarked on only by Hal and T. Axford. Schacht was in too much knee pain to remark on much of anything, and Stitt had ETA's Barry Loach inject the big purple knee with something that made Schacht's eyes roll up in his head. Then during the post-meet mixer and dance, Pemulis's defaulted opponent ate from the hors d'oeuvres table without using utensils, or at one point even hands, did a disco number when there wasn't any music going, and was finally heard telling the Port Washington headmaster's wife that he'd always wanted to do her from behind. Pemulis spent a lot of time whistling and staring innocently up at the prefab ceiling. The bus for all the 18s squads was warm, and there were little nozzles of light over your seat that you could either have on to do homework or shut off and sleep. Trulch, left eye ominously nystagmic, pretended to recap the day's match highlights for a subscription audience, speaking earnestly into his fist. The C-team's Stockhausen was pretending to sing opera. Hal and tall Paul Shaw were each reading an SAT prep guide. A good quarter of the bus was yellow highlighting copies of E.A. Abbott's inescapable at ETA book, Flatland, for either Flotman or Chawoff or Thorpe. An elongated darkness with assorted shapes melted by, plus long gauntlets near exits of tall, interstate-ish lamps laying down cones of dirty-looking sodium light. The ghastly sodium lamplight made Mario Incandenza happy to be in his little cone of white inside light. Mario sat next to K.D. Coyle, who was kind of mentally slow, especially after a hard loss, and they played rock-paper-scissors for 200 clicks or more, not saying anything, engrossed in trying to locate patterns in each other's rhythms of choices of shapes, which they both decided there weren't any. Two or three upperclassmen in Levy Richardson O'Brien Chawoff's disciplinary lit were slumped over Goncharov's Oblomov, looking very unhappy indeed. Charles Tavis sat way in the back with John Wayne and beamed and spoke nonstop in hushed tones to Wayne as the Canadian stared out the window. DeLint was with the 16s one bus back. He'd been ragging Stice's and Cornspan's asses since their doubles, which it looked like they practically gave away. The bus was Stittless. Stitt always found a private, mysterious way back, then appeared at dawn drills with DeLint and elaborate workups of everything that had gone wrong the day before. He was particularly shrill and insistent and negative after they'd won something. Schacht had listed to port and didn't respond when hands were waved in front of his face, and Axford and Struck started kibitzing Barry Loach about their knees were feeling punk as well. The luggage rack over everyone's heads bristled with grips and coverless strings, and liniment and tincture of benzoin had been handed out and liberally applied, so the warm air became complexly spiced. Everybody was tired, in a good way.
The homeward ride's camaraderie was marred only by the fact that someone near the back of the bus started the passing around of a Gothic fonted leaflet offering the kingdom of prehistoric England to the man who could pull Keith Freer out of Bernadette Longley.
Freer had been discovered by Prorector Mary Esther Thode, more or less X-ing poor Bernadette Longley under an Adidas blanket in the very back seat on the bus trip to the East Coast Clays in Providence in September, and it had been a nasty scene because there were some basic academy license rules that it was just unacceptable to flout under the nose of staff. Keith Freer was deeply asleep when the leaflet was getting passed around, but Bernadette Longley wasn't, and when the leaflet hit the front half where all the females now had to sit since September, she buried her face in her hands and flushed even on the back of her pretty neck, and her doubles partner came all the way back to where Jim Strzok and Michael Pemulis were sitting and told them in no uncertain terms that somebody on this bus was so immature it was really sad.
92.
Charles Tavis was irrepressible. He did a Pierre Trudeau impression no one except the driver was old enough to laugh at. And the whole mammoth traveling squad, three buses worth, got to stop and have the mega breakfast at Denny's, over next to Empire Waste at like 0030 when they got in. Hal's eldest brother, Oren Incandenza, got out of competitive tennis when Hal was 9 and Mario nearly 11. This was during the period of great pre-experialist upheaval and the emergence of the fringe CUSP of Johnny Gentle, famous crooner, and the tumescence of O-N-A-N-ism. At late 17, Oren was ranked in the low 70s nationally. He was a senior. He was at that awful age for a low 70s player where age 18 and the terminus of a junior career are looming, and either one, you're going to surrender your dreams of the show and go to college and play college tennis, or two, you're going to get your full spectrum of gram-negative and cholera and amoebic dysentery shots and try to eke out some kind of sad, diasporic existence on a Eurasian satellite pro tour and try to hop those last few competitive plateaus up to show caliber as an adult, or three, you don't know what you're going to do, and it's often an awful time.
93.
ETA tries to dilute the awfulness a little by letting 8 or 9 postgraduates stay on for 2 years and serve in DeLint's platoon of pro-rectors in exchange for room and board and travel expenses to small, sad satellite tourneys.
94.
And Oren's being directly related to ETA administration obviously gave him kind of a lock on a pro-rector appointment, if he wanted it. But a pro-rector's job was only for maybe, at most, a few years, and was regarded as sad and purgatorial. And then, of course, what then? What are you going to do after that, etc.? Oren's decision to attend college pleased his parents a great deal, though Mrs. Avril Incandenza, especially, had gone out of her way to make it clear that whatever Oren decided to do would please them because they stood squarely behind and in full support of him, Oren, and any decision his very best thinking yielded. But they were still in favor of college, privately, you could tell. Oren was clearly not ever going to be a professional-caliber adult tennis player. His competitive peak had come at 13, when he'd gotten to the 14-and-under quarterfinals of the National Clays in Indianapolis, Indiana, and in the quarters had taken a set off the second seed. But starting soon after that, he'd suffered athletically from the same delayed puberty that had compromised his father when himself had been a junior player, and having boys he'd cleaned the clocks of at 12 and 13 become now seemingly overnight mannish and deep-chested and hairy-legged and starting now to clean Oren's own clock at 14 and 15, this had sucked some kind of competitive afflatus out of him, broken his tennis spirit, Oren, and his USTA ranking had nosedived through 3 years until it leveled off somewhere in the low 70s. Which meant that by age 15, he wasn't even qualifying for the major event's main 64-man draw. When ETA opened, his ranking among boys' 18s hovered around 10, and he was relegated to a middle spot on the Academy's B squad, a mediocrity that sort of becalmed his verve even further. His style was essentially that of a baseliner, a counterpuncher, but without the return of serve or passing shots you need to stand much of a chance against a quality netman. The ETA rap on Oren was that he lobbed well, but too often. He did have a phenomenal lob. He could hug the curve of the dome of the lung, and 3 times out of 4 nail a large-sized coin placed on the opposite baseline. He and Marlon Bain and two or three other marginal counterpunching boys at ETA all had phenomenal lobs. Honed through spare PM devoted more and more to Eschaton, which by the most plausible account, a Croatian refugee transfer had brought up from the Palmer Academy to Tampa. Orn was Eschaton's first game master at ETA, where in the first Eschaton generations, it was mostly marginal and deaflaticized upperclassmen who played. College was the comparatively obvious choice then for Orrin, as the time of decision drew nigh. Oblique family pressures aside, as a low-ranked player at ETA, he'd had stiffer academic demands than did those for whom the real show had seemed like a viable goal. And the eschatonology helped a great deal with the math-slash-computer stuff ETA tended to be a bit weak in, both himself and Stitt being, at that point, pretty anti-quantitative. His grades were solid. His board scores weren't going to embarrass anybody. Orrin was basically academically sound, especially for a somebody with a top-level competitive sport on his secondary transcript. And you have to understand that mediocrity is relative in a sport like junior tennis. A national ranking of 74 in boys 18 and under singles, while mediocre by the standards of aspiring pros, is enough to make most college coaches' chins shiny. Orrin got a couple Pac-10 offers, Big Ten offers. University of New Mexico actually hired a mariachi band that established itself under his dorm room's window 6 nights running, until Mrs. Incandenza got himself to authorize FDV Hard to electrify the fences. Ohio State flew him out to Columbus for such a weekend of prospective orientation that when Orrin got back, he had to stay in bed for 3 days, drinking Alka-Seltzer with an ice pack on his groin. Caltech offered him an ROTC waiver and AP standing in their elite strategic studies program after Decade Magazine had run a short interest piece on Orrin and the Croat and Eschaton's applied use of
C:/pink, sub 2.
95.
Orrin chose BU, Boston University, not a tennis power. Not in Caltech's league, academically. Not the sort of place that hires bands or flies you out for Roman orgies of inducement. And only just about 3 clicks down the hill from Commonwealth Avenue, from ETA, west of the bay, around the intersection of Commonwealth and Beacon, Boston. It was kind of a joint Orrin Incandenza, Avril Incandenza decision. Orrin's moms privately thought it was important for Orrin to be away from home, psychologically speaking, but still to be able to come home whenever he wished. She put everything to Orrin in terms of worrying that her concern over what'd be best for him psychologically might prompt her to overstep her maternal bounds and speak out of turn or give intrusive advice. According to all her lists and advantage-disadvantage charts, BU was, from every angle, far and away O's best choice. But to keep ever from overstepping or lobbying intrusively, the moms actually, for 6 weeks, would flee any room Orrin entered, both hands clapped over her mouth. Orrin had this way his face would get when she'd beg him not to let her influence his choice. It was during this period that Orrin had characterized the moms to Hal as a kind of contortionist with other people's bodies, which Hal's never been able to forget. Himself, from his own experience, probably thought it'd be better for Orrin to get the hell out of Dodge altogether, do something Midwest or pack, but he kept his own counsel. He never had to struggle not to overstep. He probably figured Orrin was a big boy. This was 4 years and 30-some released entertainments before himself put his head in a microwave oven, fatally.
Then it turned out Avril's adoptive-slash-half-brother, Charles Tavis, who at this time was back chairing ASA at Throppinghamshire,
turned out to be old Minor Sport Athletic Administration Network friends with Boston University's varsity tennis coach.
96.
Tavis flew down special on Air Canada to set up a meeting between the four of them, Avril and Sun, and Tavis and the BU tennis coach. The BU tennis coach was a septuagenaric Ivy League guy, one of those emptily, craggly, handsome old patrician men whose profile looks like it ought to be on a coin, who liked his lads to wear all white and actually, literally, vault the net, win or lose, after matches. Boston University had only had a couple nationally ranked players like ever, and that had been in the AD 1960s, way before this fashion-conscious guy's tenure. And when the coach saw Oren play, he about fell over sideways. Recall how mediocrity is contextual. Boston University's players all hailed, literally, from New England country clubs, and wore ironed shorts and those faggy white tennis sweaters with that blood-colored stripe across the chest, and talked without moving their jaw, and played the sort of stiff and patrician serve and volley game you play if you've had lots of summer lessons and club round robins, but had never ever had to get out there and kill or die, psychically. Oren wore cut-off jeans and deck sneakers without socks and yawned compulsively as he beat Boston University's immaculately groomed number one singles man, 2-0, hitting something like 40 offensive lobs for winners. Then at the four-way meeting Tavis arranged, the old BU coach showed up in L.L. Bean chinos and a Lacoste polo shirt and got a look at the size of Oren's left arm, and then at Oren's mom's in a tight black skirt and Levantine jacket with coal around her eyes and a moosed tower of hair, and about fell back over sideways the other way. She had this effect on older men somehow. Oren was in a position to dictate terms limited only by the parameters of BU's own sports budget marginality.
97.
Oren signed a letter of intent accepting a full ride at BU, plus books, and a Hitachi laptop with software, and off-campus housing and living expenses, and a lucrative work-study job where his job was to turn on the sprinklers every morning at the BU football Terrier's historic Nickerson Field, sprinklers that were already on automatic timers. The sprinkler job was BU's tennis team's one plum, recruitment-wise. Charles Tavis, who at Averill's urging, had failed to cash in his Canadian return ticket and stayed on as assistant headmaster to assist Oren's father's oversight of the academy.
98.
In a progressively more and more total capacity, as both in and external travels took J.O. Incandenza away from Enfield more and more often, said 3.5 years later that he'd never really expected a thank you from Oren anyway, for liaisoning with the BU tennis apparatus, that he wasn't in this for the thank yous, that a person who did a service for somebody's gratitude was more like a 2D cutout image of a person than a bona fide person. At least that's what he thought, he said. He said, what did Averill and Hal and Mario think? Was he a genuine 3D person? Was he perhaps just rationalizing away some legitimate hurt? Did Oren maybe resent him for seeming to move in just as he, Oren, moved out? Though surely not for Tavis's assuming more and more total control of the ETA helm, as J.O. Incandenza spent increasingly long hiati, either off with Mario on shoots or editing in his room off the tunnel, or in alcoholic rehabilitative facilities. 13 of them over those final 3 years. Tavis has the Blue Cross statements right here. And even more surely not for the final fellow to say anyone with any kind of denial-free sensitivity could have predicted for the past 3.5 years. But, CT opined, on the 4th of July, YDPAH, after Oren, who now had plenty of free summer time, declined his 5th straight invitation back to Enfield and his family's annual barbecue and Wimbledon finals interlace spontaneous dissemination watching, Oren might just be harboring a resentment over CT moving into the headmaster's office and changing the doors
Teo Chidere Posent
before himself's microwaved head had even cooled, even if it was to take over a headmaster's job that had been positively keening to have someone sedulous and brisk take over. Incandenza himself, having eliminated his own map on the 1st of April of the year of the trial-sized Dove Bar, just as spring letters of intent were due from seniors who'd decided to slouch off to college tennis, just as invitations for the European Dirt Circuit Invitationals were pouring in all over lateral Alice Moore's paraboloid desk, just as ETA's tax-exempt status was coming up, for review before the MDR exemption panel.
99.
Just as the school was trying to readjust to new ONANTA accreditation procedures after years of USTA accreditation procedures. Just as litigations with Enfield Marine Public Health Hospital over alleged damage from ETA's initial hilltop flattening and with Empire Waste Displacement over the flight paths of concavity-bound displacement vehicles were reaching the appellate stage. Just as applications and fellowships for the fall term were in the final stages of review and response. Well, someone had had to come in and fill the void. And that person was going to have to be someone who could achieve total worry without becoming paralyzed by the worry or by the absence of minimal thank yous
for inglorious duties discharged in the stead of a person whose replacement was naturally going to come in for some resentment, Tavis felt.
Since you can't get mad at a dying man, much less at a dead man, who better to assume the stress of filling in as anger object than that dead man's thankless, inglorious, sedulous, untiring, 3D bureaucratic assistant and replacement, whose own upstairs room was right next to the headmaster's house's master bedroom, and who might, by some grieving parties, be viewed as some kind of interloping usurper. Tavis had been ready for all this stress and more, he told the assembled academy in preparatory remarks before last year's fall term convocation. Speaking through amplification from the red and gray bunting-draped crow's nest of Gerhard Stitt's transom down into the rows of folding chairs arranged all along the base and sidelines of ETA courts 6-9. He not only fully accepted the stress and resentment, he said he had worked hard and would continue in his dull, quiet, unromantic fashion to work hard to remain open to it, to this resentment and sense of loss and irreplaceability, even after 4 years, to let everyone who needed to get it out, get it out. The anger and resentment and possible contempt for their own psychological health, since Tavis acknowledged publicly that there was more than enough on every ETA's plate to begin with, as it was. The convocation assembly was outside, on the center courts that in winter are sheltered by the lung. It was the 31st of August in the year of dairy products from the American heartland, hot and muggy. Upperclassmen who'd heard these same basic remarks for the past 4 years made little razor to jugular and hangman's noose over imaginary crossbeam motions, listening. The sky overhead was glassy blue between clots and strings of clouds moving swiftly north. On courts 30 to 32, the applied music chorus guys kept up a background of Tenebri Facti Sunt, sotto voce. Everybody had had on the black armbands everybody still wore for functions and assemblies, to keep from forgetting. And the cotton U.S. and crisp nylon ONAN flags flapped and clanked halfway down the driveway's poles in remembrance. The Sunstrand Plaza still, as of that fall, hadn't yet found a way to muffle its East Newton ATH-SCME fans. And Tavis's voice, which even with the police bullhorn tended to sound distant, and receding anyway, wove in and out of the sound of the fans and the whump of the EWD catapults and locusts' electric screams and the exhaust-rich hot rush of the summer wind up off Commonwealth Avenue and the car horns and the green lines trundle and clang and the clank of the flags, poles, and wires. And everybody but the staff and littlest kids up front missed most of Tavis's explanation that Salick Law had nothing to do with the fact that there was simply no way the late headmaster's beloved spouse, an ETA Dean of Academic Affairs and of Females, Mrs. Avril Incandenza, could have become headmaster. How would headmistress have sounded? And she had the females and female prorectors and Hardy's custodians to oversee, and curricula and assignments and schedules, and complex new ONANTA accreditation to finalize the Kafkan application for, plus daily headmaster's house sterilization and personal ablution rituals, and the constant battle against anthracnose and dry climate blight in the dining room's green babies. Plus, of course, ETA teaching duties on top of that. With the addition of untold sleepless nights with the militant grammarians of Massachusetts, the academic pack that watchdogged media syntax and invited florid, fish-lipped guys from the French Academy to come speak with trilled R's on prescriptive preservation, and held marathon multi-readings of, for example, Orwell's Politics and the English Language, and whose Avril-chaired Tactical Phalanx, MGMs, was then unsuccessfully, it turned out, court-fighting the new Gentle Administration's Title II-G Public-Funded Library Phase-Out Fat-Trimming Initiative, besides, of course, being practically laid out flat with grief and having to do all the emotional processing work attendant on working through that kind of personal trauma, on top of all of which, assuming the administrative tiller of ETA itself, would have been simply an insupportable burden, she's thanked CT effusively on more than one public occasion for leaving the plush sinecure of Throppinghamshire and coming down to undertake the stress-ridden tasks, not only of bureaucratic administration and ensuring as smooth a transition as possible, but of being there for the Incandenza family itself, with or without thank yous, and for helping support not only Oren's career and institutional decision processes, but also for being there supportively for all involved when Oren made his seminal choice not to go ahead and play competitive college tennis after all at Boston University. What happened was that by the third week of his freshman year, Oren was attempting an extremely unlikely defection from college tennis to college football. The reason, he gave his parents, Avril made it clear that the very last thing she wanted was to have any of her children feel they had to justify or explain to her any sort of abruptly or even bizarrely sudden major decision they might happen to make. And it's not clear that the mad stork had even nailed down the fact that Oren was still in Metro Boston at BU in the first place. But Oren still felt the move demanded some kind of explanation. Was that fall tennis practice had started, and he discovered that he was an empty, withered, psychic husk, competitively burned out. Oren had been playing, eating, sleeping, and excreting competitive tennis since his racket was bigger than he was. He said he realized he had, at 18, become exactly as fine a tennis player as he was ever destined to be. The prospect of further improvement, a crucial carrot that Stitt and the ETA staff were expert at dangling, had disappeared at a fourth-rate tennis program whose coach had a poster of Bill Tilden in his office and offered critique on the level of bend your knees and watch the ball. This was all actually true, the burnout part, and totally swallowable as far as the from tennis part went. But Oren had a harder time explaining the decision's to football component, partly because he had only the vaguest understanding of U.S. football's rules, tactics, and non-metric venue. He had, in fact, never once even touched a real, pebbled leather football before. And, like most serious tennis players, had always found the misshapen ball's schizoid bounces disorienting and upsetting to look at. In fact, the decision had very little to do with football at all, or with the reason Oren ended up starting to give before Avril all but demanded that he stop feeling in any way pressured or compelled to do anything more than ask for their utter and unqualified support of whatever actions he felt his personal happiness required. Which is what she did when he started a slightly lyrical thing about the crash of pads and sis-boom-ba of pep squad and ambiance of male bonding and smell of dewy turf at Nickerson Field at dawn, when he showed up to watch the sprinklers come on and turn the lemon wedge of risen sun into plumed rainbows of refraction. The refracting sprinklers part was actually true, and that he liked it. The rest had been fiction. The real football reason, in all its inevitable real reason banality, was that, over the course of weeks of dawns of watching the auto sprinklers and the pep squad, which really did practice at dawn, practices, Oren had developed a horrible schoolboy-grade crush, complete with dilated pupils and weak knees, For a certain big-haired sophomore baton twirler, he watched twirl and strut from a distance through the diffracted spectrum of the plumed sprinklers, all the way across the field's dewy turf. A twirler, who'd attended a few of the all-athletic team mixers, Oren and his strabismic BU doubles partner had gone to, and who danced the same way she twirled and invoked mass pep, which is to say, in a way that seemed to turn everything solid in Oren's body, watery and distant and oddly refracted. Oren in Candenza, who, like many children of raging alcoholics and OCD sufferers, had internal addictive sexuality issues, had already drawn idle little sideways eights on the post-coital flanks of a dozen BU co-eds. But this was different. He'd been smitten before, but not decapitated. He lay on his bed in the autumn PMs during the tennis coach's required nap time, squeezing a tennis ball and talking for hours about this twirling, sprinkler-obscured sophomore, while his doubles partner lay way on the other side of the huge bed, looking simultaneously at Oren and the New England leaves changing color in the trees outside the window. The schoolboy epithet they'd made to refer to Oren's twirler was PGOAT, for the prettiest girl of all time. It wasn't the entire attraction, but she really was almost grotesquely lovely. She made the moms look like the sort of piece of fruit you think you want to take out of the bin, but then, once you're right there over the bin, you put back because, from close up, you can see a much fresher and less preserved-seeming piece of fruit elsewhere in the bin. The twirler was so pretty that not even the senior BU football terriers could summon the saliva to speak to her at athletic mixers. In fact, she was almost universally shunned. The twirler induced in heterosexual males what UHID later told her was termed the Acteon complex, which is a kind of deep, phylogenic fear of transhuman beauty. About all Oren's doubles partner, who as a strabismic was something of an expert on female unattainability, felt he could do, was warn O that this was the kind of hideously attractive girl you just knew in advance did not associate with normal, collegiate human males, and clearly attended BU athletic social functions only out of a sort of bland scientific interest while she waited for the cleft-chinned, ascopartic male model-looking, wildly successful in business adult male she doubtless was involved with to telephone her from the back seat of his green stretch Infinity, etc. No major sport player had ever even orbited in close enough to hear the elisions and apical lapses of a mid-southern accent in her oddly flat but resonant voice that sounded like someone enunciating very carefully inside a soundproof enclosure. When she danced at dances, it was with other cheerleaders and twirlers and pep squad terrierettes, because no male had the grit or spit to ask her. Oren himself couldn't get closer than 4 meters at parties, because he suddenly couldn't figure out where to put the stresses in the Charles Tavis unwittingly inspired, "Describe the sort of man you find attractive, and I'll affect the demeanor of that sort of man," strategic opening that would work so well on other BU subjects. It took 3 hearings for him to figure out that her name wasn't Joel. The big hair was red gold, and the skin peachy tinged pale, and arms freckled, and zygomatics indescribable, and her eyes an extra natural, high definition green. He wouldn't learn till later that the almost pungently clean, line-dried laundry scent that hung about her was a special low-pH dandelion adder decocted special by her chemist daddy in Shiny Prize, Kentucky. Boston University's tennis team, needless to say, had neither cheerleaders nor baton-twirling pep squads, which were reserved for major and large crowd sports. This is pretty understandable. The tennis coach took Oren's decision hard, and Oren had had to hand him a Kleenex and stand there for several minutes under the poster of an avuncular Big Bill Tilden, standing there in World War II-era long white pants, and ruffling a ball boy's hair. Or in watching the Kleenex sogify and get holes blown through it while he tried to articulate just what he meant by burned out and withered husk and carrot. The coach had kept asking if this meant Oren's mother wouldn't be coming down to watch practice anymore. Oren's now former doubles partner, a strabismic and faggy-sweatered but basically decent guy, who also happened to be heir to the Nickerson Farms meat facsimile fortune, had his cleft-chinned and solidly BU-connected dad make a couple quick calls from the back seat of his forest green Lexus. Boston University's head football coach, the Boss Terrier, an exiled Oklahoman who really did wear a gray crewneck sweatshirt with a whistle on a string, was intrigued by the size of the left forearm and hand extended, impolitely but not intriguingly, during introductions. This was Oren's tennis arm, roughly churn-sized. The other, whose dimensions were human, was hidden under a sport coat draped strategically over the aspiring walk-on's right shoulder. But you can't play U.S. football with a draped sport coat. And Oren's only real speed was in tiny 3-meter lateral bursts. And then it turned out that the idea of actually making direct physical contact with an opponent was so deeply ingrained as alien and horrific that Oren's tryouts, even at reserve positions, were too pathetic to describe. He was called a drag ass, and then a mollygag, and then a bona fide pussy. He was finally told that he seemed to have some kind of empty swinging sack where his balls ought to be, and that if he wanted to keep his scholarship, he might ought to stick to minor-type sports, where what you hit didn't up and hit you back. The coach finally actually grabbed Oren's face mask and pointed to the mouth of the field's southern tunnel.
Oren walked south off the field, solo and disconsolate, helmet under his little right arm,
with not even a wistful glance back at the pep squad's PGOAT, practicing baton aloft splits in a heart-renderingly distant way beneath the visitors' northern goalposts. What Metro Boston AAs are trite but correct about is that both Destiny's Kisses and its dope slaps illustrate an individual person's basic personal powerlessness over the really meaningful events in his life.
100.
That is, almost nothing important that ever happens to you happens because you engineer it. Destiny has no beeper. Destiny always leans trench-coated out of an alley with some sort of psst that you usually can't even hear because you're in such a rush to or from something important you've tried to engineer. The Destiny great event that happened to Oren Incandenza at this point was that just as he was passing glumly under the home goalposts and entering the shadow of the south exit tunnels at it, a loud and ominously orthopedic cracking sound, plus then shrieking, issued from somewhere on the field behind him. What had happened was that Boston University's best defensive tackle, a 180-kilo future pro who had no teeth and liked to color, practicing special teams punt rushes, not only blocked BU's varsity punter's kick, but committed a serious mental error and kept coming and crashed into the little padless guy while the punter's cleated foot was still up over his head, falling on him in a beefy heap and snapping everything from femur to tarsus in the punter's leg with a dreadful high-caliber snap. Two pep majorettes and a water boy fainted from the sound of the punter's screams alone. The blocked punt's ball caromed hard off the defensive tackle's helmet and bounced, crazily, and rolled untended all the way back to the shadow of the south tunnel, where Oren had turned to watch the punter writhe and the lineman rise with a finger in his mouth and a guilty expression. The defensive line coach disconnected his headset and dashed out and began blowing his whistle at the lineman at extremely close range, over and over, as the huge tackle started to cry and hit himself in the forehead with the heel of his hand. Since nobody else was close, Oren picked up the blocked punt's ball, which the head coach was gesturing impatiently for from his position at the midfield bench. Oren held the football, which he'd not been very good at during tryouts, holding on to it, feeling its weird oval weight, and looked way upfield at the stretcher bearers and punter and assistants and coach. It was too far to try to throw, and there was just no way Oren was making another solo walk up the sideline and then back off the field again under the distant green gaze of the twirler, who owned his CNS. Oren, before that seminal moment, had never tried to kick any sort of ball before in his whole life, was the unengineered and kind of vulnerable revelation that ended up moving Joelle Van Dyne way more than status or hang time. But as of that moment, as whistles fell from lips and people pointed, and under that same green and sprinkler-hazed gaze, Oren found for himself, within competitive U.S. football, a new niche and carrot. A show-type career he could never have dreamed of trying to engineer. Within days, he was punting 60 yards without a rush, practicing solo on an outside field with a special teams assistant, a dreaming Gaulois-smoking man who invoked ideas of sky and flight and called Oren Ephebe, which a discreet phone call to his youngest brother revealed not to be the insult Oren had feared it sounded like. By the second week, O was up to around 65 yards, still without a snap or rush, his rhythm clean and faultless, his concentration on the transaction between one foot and one leather egg almost frighteningly total. Nor by the third week was he much distracted by the 10 crazed, pituitary giants bearing down as he took the snap and stepped forward, the gasps and crunching and meaty splats of interpersonal contact around him, the coolly type shuffle of the stretcher bearers who came and went after the whistle blows. He'd been taken aside and the empty scrotum crack apologized for, and it had been explained, complete with blow-ups of rulebook pages, that regulations against direct physical contact with the punter were draconian, enforced by the threat of massive yardage and loss of possession. The rifle shot sounds of the ex-punter's now useless leg were one in a million sounds, he was assured. The head coach let Oren overhear him telling the defense that any man misfortunate enough to impact the team's new stellar punt man might could just keep on walking after the play was over, all the way to the South Tunnel and the stadium exit and the nearest transportation to some other institution of learning and ball. It was, pretty obviously, the start of football season. Chris Bear, everything half-dead, burning leaves, hot chocolate, raccoon coats, and halftime twirling in something called the wave. Crowds exponentially larger and more demonstrative than tennis tournament crowds. Home versus SUNY Buffalo. Home versus Syracuse at Boston College, at Rhode Island. Home versus the despised Minutemen of UMass Amherst. Oren's average reached 69 yards per kick and was still improving. His eyes fixed on the twin inducements of a gleaming baton and a massive developmental carrot he hadn't felt since age 14. He punted the football better and better as his motion, a dancerly combination of moves and weight transfers every bit as complex and precise as a kick serve, got more instinctive, and he found his hamstrings and adductors loosening through constant and high-impact competitive punting. His left cleat finishing at 90 degrees to the turf, knee to his nose, rocket kicking in the midst of crowd noise so rabid and entire it seemed to remove stadium's air, the one huge, wordless, orgasmic voice rising and creating a vacuum that sucked the ball after it into the sky, the leather egg receding as it climbed in a perfect spiral, seeming to chase the very crowd roar it had produced. By Halloween, his control was even better than his distance. It wasn't by accident that the special teams assistant described it as touch. Consider that a football field is basically just a grass tennis court, tugged unnaturally long, and that white lines at complex right angles still define tactics and movement, the very possibility of play. And that Oren Incandenza, who, tennis historically, had had mediocre passing shots, had been indicted by Stitt for depending way too often on the lob he'd developed as compensation. Like the equally weak-passing eschaton prodigy Michael Pemulis after him, Oren's whole limited game had been built around a preternatural lob, which of course a lob is just a higher-than-opponent parabola that ideally lands just shy of the area of play's rear boundary and is hard to retrieve and return. Gerhard Schtitt and DeLint and their depressing prorectors had had to sit eating butterless popcorn through only one cartridge of one BU game to understand how Oren had found his major sport niche. Oren was still just only lobbing, Schtitt observed, illustrating with the pointer and a multiple replayed fourth down, but now with the leg instead.
The only punting, and now with 10 armored and testosterone-flushed factota to deal with, whatever return an opponent could muster.
Schtitt posited that Oren had stumbled by accident on a way in this grotesquely physical and territorial U.S. game to legitimate the same dependency on the one shot of lob that had kept him from developing the courage to develop his weaker areas, which this unwillingness to risk the temporary failure and weakness for long-term gain had been the real herbicide on the carrot of Oren Incandenza's tennis. Puberty schmuberty, as the real reason for burning down the inside fire for tennis, Schtitt knew. Schtitt's remarks were nodded vigorously at and largely ignored in the viewing room. Schtitt later told DeLint he had several very bad feelings about Oren's future inside. But so, by freshman Halloween, Oren was regularly placing his punts inside the opponent's 20, spinning the ball off his cleat's laces so it either hit and squiggled outside the white sideline and out of play, or just landed on its point and bounced straight up and seemed to squat in the air, hovering and spinning, waiting for some downfield terrier to kill it just by touching. The special teams assistant told Oren that these were historically called coffin corner kicks, and that Oren Incandenza was the best natural coffin corner man he'd lived to see. You almost had to smile. Oren's full-ride scholarship was renewed under the aegis of a brutaler but way more popular North American sport than competitive tennis. This was after the second home game, around the time that a certain actionizingly pretty baton twirler, invoking mass pep during breaks in the action, seemed to begin somehow directing her glittering sideline routines at Oren in particular. So, and then, the only really cardiac-grade romantic relationship of Oren's life took bilateral root at a distance during games, without one exchanged personal phoneme, a love communicated across grassy expanses, against stadium's monovocal roar, entirely through stylized repetitive motions. His functional, hers celebratory, their respective little dances of devotion to the spectacle they were both, in their different roles, trying to make as entertaining as possible. But so the point was that the accuracy came after the distance. In his first couple games, Oren had approached his fourth down task as one of simply kicking the ball out of sight and past hope of return. The dreamy special team assistant said this was a punter's natural pattern of growth and development. Your raw force tends to precede your control. In his initial home start, wearing a padless uniform that didn't fit and a wide receiver's number, he was summoned when Boston University's first drive stalled on the 40 of a Syracuse team that had no idea it was in its last season of representing an American university. A side issue. College sport analysts would later use the game to contrast the beginning and end of different eras, but a side issue. Oren had a booked long of 73 yards that day and an average hang of 8-point-something seconds, but that first official punt exhilarated. The carrot, the PGOAT, the monovocal roar of a major sport crowd, he sent over the head of the orangeman back waiting to receive it, over the goalposts and the safety nets behind the goalposts, over the first three sections of seats, and into the lap of an emeritus theology prof in row 52 who'd needed opera glasses to make out the play itself. It went in the books at 40 yards, that baptismal competitive punt. It was really almost a 90-yard punt, and had the sort of hang time the special team's assistant said you could have tender and sensitive intercourse during.